Culture.
Classical composers. A maestro, due an encore. Arnold Schoenberg, born 150 years ago, was one of music's most important rebels.
"Were I a gambling man," Glenn Gould said in 1966, "I would be very inclined to place my money on the prospect for immortality of Arnold Schoenberg above and beyond any other composer who's lived in our era." Gould, a Canadian pianist, was not expressing an outlandish opinion. Schoenberg, who was born 150 years ago on September 13, 1874, revolutionized Western music. By the middle of the 20th century, his music was probably more influential than that of any other composer. Aaron Copland, an American composer, felt that all contemporary music owes something to his daring. Yet it was probably a good thing Gould did not bet, as Schoenberg has mostly vanished from the public consciousness. Other mould breakers of the past century, Pablo Picasso, for instance, or the Expressionists, are still celebrated. Igor Stravinsky, who, like Schoenberg, provoked a concert hall uproar in 1913, is beloved by classical music audiences. So why is Schoenberg a ghost by comparison? The 150th birthday offers an opportunity to think anew about an idiosyncratic figure. Born into a Jewish family in Vienna, he became a Lutheran in 1898, a strange way to seek acceptance in Catholic Austria. Schoenberg had an avant-gardist disdain for the public. He thought the artist was always against the world. He made difficult demands of musicians, too. An early oratorio calls for 3 choruses, 5 solo singers, and 150 instruments. Schoenberg's String Quartet No. 2, composed in 1907 to 1908, broke with convention by adding songs. The more radical innovation came in the 4th movement, where Schoenberg did away with a key signature. Its absence signified the advent of what came to be known as atonality, though Schoenberg did not like the term. The key signature is a home address. Before Schoenberg, composers were straying in increasingly audacious ways, but they tended to return. Unsettling dissonance would be followed by comforting consonants. Schoenberg spurned such comfort. In his free atonal works, no chord has special status. Musical phrases do not resolve in satisfying cadences. In throwing off the shackles of tonality, Schoenberg sought a musical language that could better express emotional truths. After the trauma of the First World War, Schoenberg devised his version of a form of atonality called serialism. The musical foundation of a piece would be a row of all 12 possible notes, none of which could be repeated until all had been heard. The row itself would become a new sort of home. But atonality, whether free or serial, alienated listeners. One Viennese newspaper printed its report on the premiere of the 2nd quartet in the crime section. After encountering some of Schoenberg's atonal works, Richard Strauss, a fellow composer, declared that his peer should shovel snow, not write scores. Schoenberg saw himself as saving the tradition that he seemed to defy. His music, he declared, was no more revolutionary than any other development in musical history. He found followers who themselves were among the century's most significant composers. With Alban Berg and Anton Webern, he formed the 2nd Viennese School. The first one included Beethoven, Haydn, and Mozart. After he emigrated to America to escape the Nazis and returned to Judaism, Schoenberg became a seer to a generation of composers. Pierre Boulez, a French composer, thundered that all non-serial composers are useless. He also damned the Austrian for failing to take his revolution further. Even Stravinsky, Schoenberg's greatest rival, began composing 12-tone pieces in the 1950s. Yet as Schoenberg's influence grew, the popularity of new classical music started to shrink. It became preoccupied with solving musical puzzles and found a friendlier home in universities than in concert halls. One Schoenberg acolyte, Milton Babbitt, wrote an essay in 1958 called Who Cares If You Listen? Composers care, as it turns out. To find his voice, John Adams, a popular composer of contemporary classical music, needed to cast off Schoenberg, the darkest and most intimidating of all the figures in my personal gallery. The work with which Mr. Adams broke out of a long creative lockdown was Harmonielehrer. With deliberate irony, the symphony takes the title of a harmony textbook by Schoenberg. It was a statement of belief in the power of tonality at a time when I was uncertain about its future, Mr. Adams wrote in his memoir. These days, devotees lament, Schoenberg's music is too little heard. People just feel scared when they see it in the programme, says Claire Booth, a British soprano. All the same, she is a little surprised at the reticence of concert venues to put on Schoenberg's music in his anniversary year. Yet he achieved immortality, if not in the way Gould thought he would. His boldness encouraged later composers to go in whatever direction they wanted, which helps to account for the profusion of styles in classical music today. Anna Klein, who used a 12-tone row in her violin concerto The Seamstress, says that Schoenberg's musical journey grants permission for future composers to try new compositional techniques, whatever their musical language may be. Classical music fans have a lot to thank Schoenberg for, whether they know it or not.